Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. And our question number one, it was on this day back in 1958 in Kalamazoo, Michigan, that the very first Flying V was introduced. So, what is a Flying V anyway? Is it A Flying V was the next iteration of an amplifier that followed the Flying U? Or is it B, a Flying V was a marching band formation used at halftime in football games? Or is it C, the Flying V was a type of guitar developed by Gibson? Or is it D, the Flying V was a band that eventually became known as the Crickets? So, 1958, Kalamazoo, Michigan, what is a Flying V? And question number two, was on this day back in 1999 that country singer Garth Brooks did something a bit unusual for a country music star? What was it that he did on this day back in 1999? Was it A, he attended spring training camp with the San Diego Padres baseball team? Was it B, he joined singer Prince on stage in Las Vegas to help him party like it's 1999? Or was it C, he played a flute with the Houston Symphony Orchestra? Or was it D, he refused to perform at the Grand Ole Opry? So on this day, back in 1999, what did Garth Brooks do? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com. And today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of February 21st. Well, it was on this day, back in 1685, that composer George Friedrich Handel was born. Handel was a German, later British, Baroque composer who spent the bulk of his career in London, becoming well-known for his oratorio, Messiah, born today, back in 1685. And it was 119 years ago today, 1911, that Gustav Mahler conducted his last concert. He collapsed immediately afterward from a severe streptococcal infection and died a few months later. ClassicFM.com notes that Mahler was a neurotic composer who triumphed over appalling childhood memories and an obsession with mortality to become the last great romantic composer. His last concert? Today, back in 1911. And in country music news, we have this article titled, Luke Combs, and it's written by Joseph Hudak, published in Rolling Stone magazine, December 2019 issue. The country music that Luke Combs loved as a kid growing up in North Carolina in the 90s may not be considered the coolest by today's standards. Instead of outlaw music or alt-country, he was a big fan of mainstream Nashville hitmakers, Brooks and Dunn, Garth Brooks and Clint Black. I'd love to lie to you so that people would think I was cool and say I was listening to Merle Haggard when I was 10, but I wasn't, Combs says. Combs' ability to channel that unabashed populism has helped make him one of the biggest stars in country music right now. The burly singer-songwriter who performs in an oversized fishing shirt and baseball cap has scored 6 number one singles in the past 3 years, including the undeniable stomper, Beer Never Broke My Heart. His debut album, This One's For You, just matched Shania Twain's record-setting 50 weeks at number one on the country charts. While many of his Nashville peers are experimenting with hip-hop and electronic beats, Combs embraces the big hooks of the 90s powerhouses he admires, while adding his own sense of easygoing relatability. I don't think that there's a wall between me and my audience, Combs, not 29, says of his success. There's not anything that makes people go, oh, I can never be like that guy. Combs didn't grow up thinking he would ever be a musician. He picked up a guitar for the first time at 21 years old when he was attending North Carolina's Appalachian State University, the same school that one of his more recent heroes, Eric Church, graduated from. But starting late didn't hurt Combs. I was writing from the second I was good enough at guitar to do it, he says. It wasn't based on anything. I never realized how much time folks spend on trying to figure out what their sound is. I had that from the first 2 or 3 songs I wrote. He formed a band, and it played any bar that would let me, he says. We made really good money, especially for college kids. I knew I could have stayed there and done that forever, but I wanted something more out of it. He dropped out of college, moved to Nashville in 2014, promoting himself by posting 6-second song clips on the social media app Vine. His crowds got bigger, and he made a point to spend hours after each show mingling with the fans. Luke would walk off stage, put in a dip, get a Jack and diet, and he'd take pictures from 45 minutes to 2 hours, says his co-manager, Chris Cappy. Combs' 2016 song Hurricane, a plain-spoken breakup ballad that compares seeing a former lover to a devastating storm, landed him a record deal with Columbia Nashville. 2017's This One's For You went double platinum, and he was nominated for Best New Artist at last year's Grammys. Combs had a difficult time adjusting to his new career at first. I was so busy I didn't get to see any of my friends or my fiancée as much as I wanted to. She was still working full-time. I didn't get to see my parents. Those were trying times for me. It was a wild time. He wrote a song about that loneliness, Dear Today, which appears on his just-released second album, What You See Is What You Get, one of the most anticipated country releases this year. I'm great now, Combs says, describing his adjustment to fame. I'm the best I've ever been, and being 29 now, I'm more comfortable in my skin. I'm not ashamed of any part of my personality. I know who I am. The best part of success, Combs says, is having the opportunity to boost the careers of his friends, like his frequent co-writers, Ray Fulcher and Rob Williford, who have become in-demand songwriters in Nashville after scoring hits with Combs. Me giving my friends the ability to achieve their dreams, that's the thing for me, he says. That's what brings me joy. I'm not a stuff guy. Don't get me wrong, I like having a nice truck and everything, but I don't want a fleet of Rolls Royces. DeLeves' Waltz for Coppelia introduces our classical music news. DeLeves, by the way, was born on this very day, back in 1836. The article is from classical/music.com, BBC, by Jeremy Pound. It's entitled Composers with Wretched Love Lives. We take a look at the painful world of passion. When it comes to love, the great composers are, frankly, pretty much like the rest of us. Take a look through the musical history books and you'll find plenty who enjoyed long, happy, and devoted relationships with their other halves, such as Grieg, Britten, or, heading further back, Tallis, for instance. Then there are those whose affairs of the heart were ardent and turbulent in equal measure, often matching their own music, the likes of romantics Chopin, Schumann, and Wagner spring to mind here. There were some who simply didn't care, and then, alas, there were the composers for whom, for one reason or another, love brought more than its fair share of pain. Some were cruelly rejected by the objects of their fondest desires. Others found themselves lumbered with spouses they could scarcely abide, and others were driven by jealousy to the brink of despair, or worse. As the calendar leaves February, then we present composers who, we suspect, would have greeted this past Valentine's Day with all the excitement of a trip to the dentist or a morning spent on blocking a sink. Joseph Haydn, 1732 to 1809, was married for 30 years, but not to whom he'd have liked. As a young man, the Austrian composer fell madly in love with Therese Keller, the daughter of a Viennese wig maker, but his would-be parents-in-law had other plans. Therese was sent to a nunnery, leaving Joseph to marry her older sister, Maria Anna, instead. Duly wed in 1860, the two were at loggerheads from almost day one. The marriage was childless, both had affairs, she with a painter and he with a soprano, and gossip about their feuding became standard fare. The Swedish composer Berwald reported that they say in Vienna that Haydn's rather unhappy and childless marriage is the reason why he composed so much. Like Haydn, Franz Schubert, 1797 to 1828, also fell in love with a Therese, but in the then teenage composer's case, his hopes of wedlock were shortened and shattered, not by the will of her parents, but by his own penury. A law at the time prohibited marriage if the man could not prove his financial wherewithal to support a family. Later in his short life, Schubert became smitten with one of his pupils, Countess Caroline Esterhazy, but she, it would seem, had little interest in her skint, short, puffy-faced admirer, despite his obvious talents. He then had to turn elsewhere for pleasure. Whether or not the syphilis that brought about his death at just 31 was the result of regular visits to prostitutes is not known. In 1900, Alexander Zemlinsky, 1871 to 1942, became besotted with his piano student, the mesmerizingly beautiful Alma Schindler. She, in return, described him as a, quote-unquote, chinless, toothless, unwashed gnome. Nonetheless, she also found him strangely fascinating, and a relationship of sorts developed between them, though by all accounts it remained unconsummated. Hovering in the background, meanwhile, was one Gustav Mahler, who eventually made his move. Zemlinsky was devastated when Mahler and Alma married in 1902, and evidently had still not got over it by 1923, when he wrote his Lyric Symphony, a work telling about the woes of unrequited love. Thank you. And in blues music news, we have this article called The Best Music Books of 2019. And this is written by David Dan, published in Rolling Stone magazine, January 2020 issue. Guitar King, Michael Bloomfield's Life in the Blues. A guitar hero who never wanted to be one, Bloomfield was a white Jewish kid of enormous talent who played on Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone and at his War Cry Electric set at the Newport Folk Festival. But Bloomfield hated stardom, and what unfolded is the story of a genius relegated to footnote status. By a self-sabotaging streak, Dan lays out in tragic, vivid detail.
Wins is worse. Thirst is also sad.
And in music research and technology, we have this article entitled, A Bull Market for Music History. This is published in Rolling Stone magazine, December 2019 issue. Turns out, if the price is right, you can buy something priceless below some musical artifacts that are necessarily and recently went to the highest bidding fans. Starting out here with John Lennon's piano, that sold for $719,000. The Beatles-era upright piano Lennon used to compose Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and A Day in the Life was purchased by the owner of the Indianapolis Colts. Then there's Michael Jackson's crystal glove that sold for $125,000. The right-hand glove for the Jackson's 1981 Triumph Tour evidently hasn't diminished in value, despite its owner's posthumous reputation problems. And then there's Ronnie James Dio's garden gnome for $2,240 it sold. In 2003, this cursed gnome fell on the thumb of former Black Sabbath frontman, severing the tip. Though Dio was concerned he would never again be able to make the sign of the devil, a doctor successfully reattached the end of the digit. Tame Impala's It Might Be Time introduces our rock and pop music news. It's an article entitled, Tame Impala, Take Us Even Higher. Psychedelic pop conjurer Kevin Parker opens up his massive bag of sonic tricks. This is written by John Dolan, published in Rolling Stone magazine, February 2020. Tame Impala's new album is entitled The Slow Rush, and it's given almost 4 full stars out of 5 possible. Kevin Parker is a prog rock whiz with a heart of pop gold, spooling out resplendent psychedelic symphonies in Tame Impala, a studio project that's blossomed into a band big enough to headline Coachella. With his long hair and spacey jams, he can recall a bygone era of art rock conjurer. Those 70s audio droods holed up in sound caves, subsisting on psilocybin tea and holding philosophical discourses with their beard fleas. But Parker's a modern guy, and his music works because he balances pie-eyed grandeur with sugary sleekness. It's part of the reason Rihanna covered one of his songs and why he's been tapped to work with Lady Gaga, Kanye West, and other stars. So that song, It Might Be Time, is from the new album, The Slow Rush. You might note that Parker sounds a bit like the old Todd Rundgren from the 1970s, and the song is about aging. As the title indicates, it might be time, and as the lyrics suggest, you're not as cool as you used to be. This album, The Slow Rush, is Tame Impala's first album since their 2015 breakout, Currents. Parker still sings like a Bee Gee with the soul of Bowie's Major Tom, floating above his thick disco, funk, and trip-hop beats, beautifully manicured synth textures and easeful yacht-soul melodies, even when songs wander off in diffuse eddies, or when he crams several distinct micro-movements into the same tune, everything seems obsessively considered, as if he spends more time perfecting the hi-hat clicks than most artists take making their whole record. If someone told you an army of musicians had contributed to The Slow Rush, you wouldn't be surprised, but the credits read simply, "All music written, performed, and mixed by Kevin Parker." He does his Brian Wilson thing in a dozen different directions. Album opener, One More Year, comes on expansive and polished like a space cruiser that just rolled off the assembly line. Glitchy Daft Punk's gone doo-wop vocoder, crooning fades into swirling disco drums, a subtle bass rumble and splashes of chicky guitar as Parker sings about a perfect future just over the horizon. Tomorrow's dust is a hazy shade of hippie folk splendor, all spindly acoustic filigree, forlorn fuzzbox jive, sensitive bongo taps, laser beam synths, and gently sung lyrics that evoke pillowy alienation. Parker isn't afraid to wear his musical passions on his sleeve. Glimmer highlights his deep devotion to the Balearic Bert of classic Chicago house music and Detroit techno on track. Parker's soft rock poet and the keyboards at the opening of the song which opened this section, Might Be Time, send a clear signal that he's the kind of cat who keeps one copy of Supertramp's Breakfast in America for the house and another for the beach house. The article skips down, ends with this. As mood music, it's a sweet trip. Let's drink this magic potion of love and emotion he offers on the radiantly sunny Instant Destiny. So sit back, relax, and have a swig. It'll take the edge off. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this day back in 1958 in Kalamazoo, Michigan, that the very first Flying V was introduced. So what is a Flying V anyway? Correct answer, answer C, a type of Gibson guitar. As noted in Gibson.com, introduced in 1958 and only made in limited quantities, the Gibson Flying V has taken flight over the years along with legions of followers. This Flying V carries heritage to new heights. The antique natural finish, mahogany body, and slim taper neck with rosewood fingerboard provide classic look, sound, and playability. A special set of calibrated Burst Bucker 2 neck and Burst Bucker 3 bridge pickups provide that perfect mix of volume, tone, and power. And the answer to our second question, it was on this day back in 1999 that country singer Garth Brooks did something a bit unusual for a country music star. What was it that he did on this day back in 1999? Correct answer, answer A. He actually attended spring training camp with the San Diego Padres baseball team. As noted in baseballreference.com, on February 12, 2019, country singer Garth Brooks, a huge baseball fan, was signed by the San Diego Padres to a minor league contract and invited to spring training. The corner infielder, corner outfielder went 1-for-22, an average of .045, and was used mostly as a pinch hitter and left fielder. His lone hit was a pinch hit second inning single off Mike Soroka on March the 21st. Upon arriving at first base, he was greeted by a hug from Chicago White Sox first baseman Frank Thomas. He wore uniform number 77. Brooks had previously taken batting practice with the Seattle Mariners in 1998 while in town for a series of concerts. He also was in spring training with the New York Mets in 2000, 0-for-17, 4 walks, and the Kansas City Royals in 2004. With the Royals, he had at least one hit, a March 10th infield single off the Mariners' Mike Myers. I was even more surprised than the pitcher, Brooks recounted in 2019. At the age of 57, he returned to spring training for a week, this time with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Although there was no intention of his seeing any game action this time, this was done to mark the 20th anniversary of the Garth Brooks Teammates for Kids Foundation, which has raised over $100 million for children's charities. He said he was a Pirates fan growing up in Oklahoma. Brooks played baseball in high school and earned a track and field scholarship to Oklahoma State University. His event, the Javelin. So let's close out today's program with the Andrews Sisters singing a tribute to Garth's favorite pastime.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack.
I don't care if we never get back.
Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. So it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the ballgame.
Well, we've run out of time for today's ballgame and episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long. Until next time.
Three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.